So a couple of questions have come up about respiratory protection, the masks. We've, talked a lot about N95s and particulate masks, but if the community's wearing their homemade mask, is that going to help?
No, the time that the mask is most helpful is when you are expelling virus, you're at risk of expelling virus toward other people. So usually we think of it as being most helpful when you are sort of coughing or sneezing. Then certainly, any mask would help. We know much more about the surgical masks. I think for most people in day-to-day life, there may be less benefit from wearing a mask everywhere. It's also not harmful. I can say that in the hospital now, we're having all hospital employees wear a mask regardless of whether or not they have symptoms, regardless of whether or not they're seeing patients at that moment, just to reduce the spread in case any of us are pre-symptomatic.
And along that line, I know just this morning, Providence Health System has gone to the universal mask for all of our employees.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I think it makes sense in a hospital setting where, the risk of having the virus and not knowing it yet is higher, where the consequences of spreading it are higher because you're interacting with more people. In terms of day-to-day life, for most people, I don't think it would have as much benefit, but I think within a hospital setting, it makes a lot of sense.
Now, we seem to get most national coverage from what's happening in New York, and we haven't really heard much about what's happening in Boston, but what are you seeing on the ground over the last 2 weeks in Boston?
So we're definitely seeing cases of coronavirus in Boston, and we're definitely seeing the number of cases increasing every day. So I think the fear among healthcare providers is that we are on our way to looking like New York. I will say we've had sort of more of a stay-at-home order for almost 2 weeks now, and so there's some, I think optimism or hope that that may mitigate what's coming, but I think there's part of us who sees what we're experiencing right now is very similar to what New York was experiencing a couple weeks ago. So I worry.
Dr. Platt, in Alaska, we've talked about the alternate care site that for these mild patients who are either corona positive or are very suspicious for it, who may need some supplemental oxygen, maybe some IV fluids, but really not more care than that. And so in Alaska, all of our the state has said you need to think about alternate care sites for those individuals. Are you doing something like that in Boston?
So, I mean, we have alternate sites for the evaluation of people who have symptoms. You want to sort of, right now most of our outpatient care is done over the phone or over video. At this point, there's a lot less coming into clinic and seeing a patient. So I think sometimes there's a lot of interest in being able to evaluate a patient in alternate sites. But I don't think we have as much in the way of, other care sites for people who you think may have coronavirus.
And I
I think
think.
that's something to think about more as we have patients who are ready for discharge from the hospital and we want to send them to a place where they can have ongoing care.
Sure.
Right now, we're usually just saying people are either well enough to stay at home or sick enough to need to be in the hospital, and we don't have much in terms of that middle ground.
And in Alaska, because we're, we have several tertiary care hospitals in Anchorage, but the outlying communities are smaller hospitals. For example, we're a critical access hospital with 25 beds. And the thought was with these alternate care sites for those mild patients who needed some supplemental oxygen, so that we didn't overwhelm our more intensive capacity. So we're seeing that. We're moving towards that process.
That sounds like a great idea. How are you guys staffing those sites?
That's a work in progress right now. And we have an alternate site. Those will be patients who are actually positive or probably positive. You know, as Dr. Jones said, it takes 4 or 5 days to get a test back from either the state health department, or if it goes to Quest or LabCorp. So then, and we're actually working on that. We just had a what we call a surge meeting with the hospital and the clinics this morning. How are we going to staff that? How are we going to provide oxygen? And we're talking, you know, nasal prong oxygen or nasal cannula oxygen just for a couple liters. And maybe they need some IV fluid. So we'll probably staff that with a nurse and maybe CNAs. But we're in the process of figuring that out literally as we speak, so that we can be ready for a group of individuals who need some care more than they can have at home. But we're trying to save the main hospital for the more intensive patients, and yet keep the hospital open for surgeries that are emergent, you know, deliveries. So we're trying to keep this cohort of patients out that are likely positive, and hopefully the majority of our patients are going to be in the mild category or asymptomatic and can do it at home.
Yeah, I'm glad that you guys are sort of planning in advance and not waiting until your hospital is bursting at the seams to think about alternate care settings. So it's sort of a great way to learn from the experiences of other cities.
So I have another listener question about more like a transmissibility. So if you have somebody living in the same house who we know is infected with COVID, is it realistic that the rest of the household could avoid getting infected, or is that a pretty difficult thing?
So we have known families where not everybody gets infected, and I think some of it has to do with the diligence of that family. If there's another room that they can stay in, if they can use, you know, one recommendation we give is paper plates and paper cups, so you don't have to worry about cleaning dishes all the time, but just really keep things separate. It is possible. It certainly requires a lot of work and a lot of attentiveness.
And kind of following up on that, let's say by July, this illness has kind of died down and we're kind of loosening our guard again. Just guessing, would you expect at some point another wave of this to go across the U.S., like in the fall or even in a year's time?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, that's kind of where it depends on whether or not this behaves like the common cold coronaviruses, which tend to be seasonal and tend to come back every year. If it's something more like SARS or MERS, I think most people suspect that it'll be more like the common cold type coronaviruses, and that it may come back in the fall after we've sort of learned our lessons from this first pass with it. But I don't think we really know that yet.
Now, this came up yesterday when we were just talking about this, about the populations that are at risk. Are there any medications that you would take people off of?
No, I would not. I mean, so the question came up about steroids and whether or not that's effective. Oftentimes, you know, there are people who have underlying lung disease. You think they're at risk for severe consequences if they get coronavirus, but if you're having a COPD exacerbation or asthma exacerbation, you need that versus steroids to help you get better. You know, I think we are right now still recommending that you treat the disease that we know that you have. There's been a lot of questions about some of the cardiac medications that affect that ACE2 receptor, so ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers, but we really don't know enough information about how those impact the disease course yet either. And so if we know that it's working for your hypertension, you just keep it on for your hypertension. So I think we just don't know enough to change our routine recommendations for diseases that we do understand.
Has the group expanded from the at-risk population to include other groups that require hospitalization?
Yeah, I mean, so when you look at the statistics, certainly the risk of a severe outcome is a lot higher in older adults or people with underlying medical conditions. But when thousands and thousands of people are infected, then, you know, a small odds of getting sick if you're otherwise young and healthy is still going to play out. And so we certainly aren't seeing young, healthy people who are in the hospital requiring intensive care. Similar to what you see with influenza every year, where most people do okay, but because it's such a widespread infection for the unlucky number, it's going to play out in a severe way.
Dr. Platt, what's Boston doing for, because I assume you have a homeless population and normally they're in shelter situations where they're fairly close together. So what are you guys doing to try and prevent the spread in that basically a vulnerable population? And if somebody is positive or suspicious but doesn't meet the criteria to really be in the hospital, how are you guys handling that?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's something that keeps a lot of us up at night. Certainly people who are homeless or people who are staying in shelters and congregate settings are a priority for being tested if they show any symptoms whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I know that our Boston Public Health Commission and the state health department are looking at finding ways to sort of help people along the way if they do become infected, but it's a hard problem to address.
So I'm going to ask a listener question from yesterday. So they asked, would you fly right now? And if you did fly, what would you do to protect yourself while flying?
I would not fly right now for a number of reasons. You know, some of it being I don't want to be exposed to anything more than I have to be exposed to. I'm at higher risk for having coronavirus since I am coming into work in the hospital today. So I'm exposed to more people. So just from an infection control perspective, I wouldn't want to fly. And then also, you know, I want to be available to the hospital here where I can be of service. For people who do have to fly, I think it's routine recommendations. Again, you know, washing your hands frequently, not touching your face as much as you can. So I think if you're riding an airplane and you can go that airplane ride without eating, I would not eat on the plane. And, you know, wash your hands when you get off and you have a cleaner place to eat. There is some reassurance about the transmission of virus within the plane in terms of the air filters. We think that those do a pretty good job of limiting spread, and so it's really just a few rows around you that are at higher risk.
Yeah, I'm hoping the airlines start complying with the 6 feet of room for me when I fly, but I'm not counting on it.
Fly first class.
You know, you guys asked a question yesterday that I thought was pretty important, was talking about mutations. Have we seen mutations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think any virus, you see mutations. There have been mutations in coronavirus. I think what we don't know, again, among so many other things, is what the implications of those mutations are. It seems to be sort of a expected rate of mutations, maybe even a little bit less than influenza. But I think the fear with mutations is that if something mutates really quickly, it can become even more deadly or infectious. I don't think we've really seen that play out yet. The other fear is that if things mutate too quickly, then your ability to sort of be immune from getting reinfected decreases. But we really don't know those consequences yet. All we know is that it is mutating.
So a few more listener questions. People who have high-risk relatives are asking, is it inevitable that everyone's probably going to get infected with this at some point?
I don't think that it's necessarily inevitable that everybody's going to get infected at some point. Again, I think the hope would be that we could stave off infection long enough to develop a vaccine. Stave off this widespread community transmission long enough so that in the future, when, you know, if it starts popping up again, we have the capacity to test early and then separate early. You know, I remain optimistic that it's not going to be the entire population. Certainly, that's where people talk about herd immunity and somewhere between 40 and 70%. When that happens, the transmission to the rest of the population decreases.
Another question from a listener. Are smokers, drinkers, and drug users at higher risk?
It's a good question. I think that there is concern that smokers are at higher risk. I don't know as much about whether or not drinkers or drug users are at higher risk, apart from saying that drinking and drug use can have consequences on people's cardiovascular health, and we know that those consequences lead to a higher risk of severe outcomes. So maybe indirectly, but I don't know as much about the direct effects.
So this is a plea for all of my smokers out there to quit smoking. This is a good excuse to improve your overall health.
Yeah.
I will second that. I have so many smokers who are down to 2 or 3 a day, and I'm like, you might as well just end it. Just put it out of its misery.
The final push.
Yeah.
Kind of motivation.
You had a question in here about, is there anything you can do in daily habits other than stopping smoking to take quinine or take herbs? Is there anything that you can use to maybe improve your chances?
Nothing that I know of. You know, I think the common sense things that we tell people to stay healthy, you know, getting enough sleep and eating a healthy diet and helping your body be as healthy as possible at baseline, so that if you get infected, you have a better ability to fight the virus. But I don't know as much about, you know, day-to-day interventions. I would hazard against exuberant use of things like quinine or vitamins. You know, I think that we know that in large doses, any of those things have side effects and toxicities, and I certainly would not.
So you're saying our audience should not be getting their quinine through drinking enough gin and tonics a day to stave it off.
It's got to help something, though.
No comment.
Have you been following any of the plasma research? I know there's a lot of people talking about plasma research from recovered patients as being the panacea.
Oh, I don't think it's a panacea. I think it's a thing that people are interested in and invested in. But, you know, for that to work, you have to have somebody who was infected, who recovered, who then donates their plasma to somebody else. So inherently, you need to have a lot of infected people in order to generate the plasma. You know, this is something that's been studied with enthusiasm in the past with influenza. I don't think, you know, it necessarily played out. I think there are people who are excited about the ability to use it in a small situation. So, you know, specifically in pandemic settings, if you can pool enough plasma and really study it and figure out what dose of antibodies you need and then give that to the illest patients or the people who are at highest risk, you know, maybe in that limited setting it could have a role, but I don't think as a widespread intervention.
How has this most changed your outside of your work? How has this most changed your day-to-day life back in Boston?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, I do practice social distancing, so I meet up with my friends over FaceTime or on the phone rather than in person. You know, I enjoy running, and I've continued to be able to do that, but I you know, largely do solo activities. I will say one positive benefit of it is that because now most of my interactions with people are on the phone or over FaceTime, I'm now reaching out to people who are outside of my immediate circle a little bit more. So spending more time talking to friends who live in other cities or other states and talking to family who live far away, you know, I think that's been a positive change. Curious about you guys. How are things looking different in Kodiak?
So I feel like we are really blessed here because we can go to a beach and not even see another person and go for walks through the woods. We're a little more spread out here. It truly is a blessing to be here because there is room to roam here, and you don't feel like if you go outside you're going to be running into 20 people. And so I know we're supposed to be socially isolating. I still encourage people to get out and exercise, but do so in a responsible manner where you're staying away from other people as you exercise. I still go out on my boat. I feel like it's the ultimate social isolation that I can go out there by myself and be miles away from the nearest person. But for me, It's been hardest on my kids, I think, because you know, my middle son's in his senior year of high school, and this is the way he's going to end high school, is at home. And my oldest son is supposed to be at college, but he's doing it online now, and it's not the way he expects to do electrical engineering. It's a kind of a tough way to learn it. But my daughter gets to sleep in a little more, so she likes that.
Yeah, good silver lining.
I think taking what Evan has said there is that, you know, we have to practice our social distancing, but we have to keep our mental health. And exercise is one of the things that helps keep your mental health. And I know it's hard for people to, but at some point at nighttime or sometime during the day, you have to quit thinking about coronavirus and think about your own health for at least a few hours. And Dr. Platt's, you know, smiling on the video thing here, because I'm sure that your brain, you probably can't turn off all the questions we just ask you.
So I'm going to turn back to medical a little bit. Are there any co-infections that you're seeing with the coronavirus?
So surprisingly few. There was initially, you know, initially a thought that we could just sort of screen people when testing for coronavirus was very limited, that we would just test somebody for the flu and the other viruses that we could test for, and if those were positive, we would say, you don't have coronavirus, you just have this one virus. And certainly there have been some patients where that is wrong. When we now have the ability to test for multiple viruses, we see multiple viruses. There are people who have coronavirus and then, you know, bacterial lung infection as well, but it's not that common. Reassuringly, not been a huge issue.
It sounds like the coronavirus makes the lungs pretty wet. Have you seen bacterial overgrowth very often because of those moist lungs?
You know, I personally have not, and I don't think in the case reports from other places that have seen the pandemic play out more than Boston, that it's been a large contributor. Certainly, it comes up, but not, you know, something we think about a lot with influenza, that after you have influenza, you're at risk for a bacterial infection in your lungs. And I don't think we see that as much with coronavirus. Maybe with time we'll see it more, but so far it has been reassuringly not as common.
So Dr. Platt makes a good point that we still need to have our influenza vaccination, because we know that if you have the viral influenza, you're subsequently more at risk for bacterial infections. I mean, we've definitely seen that. So along with social distancing, quitting smoking, having your influenza vaccine every year is a good preventative health measure.
Yeah. And maybe when we have to get your coronavirus vaccine every year.
There you go.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this is going to be a standard immunization that stands alone, or is it going to be put into the flu shot, or what is it going to, how are we going to administer this?
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, I think we have to find a vaccine that works first, and then again, it's that question of how much the virus mutates, if it's something that you need every year, or if it's something that, once you get it, you get it.
So that is a question that came up. I've had several people say that they've heard, read of people who have been infected by this, gotten better, and then gotten reinfected from this. Do you buy that?
I have not seen that described yet. It's possible that the people who have heard of this know about some source of information that I've not been exposed to yet. I know that I think the best information that we have is actually really sadly a study that they did on monkeys where they inoculated them with the virus, waited for them to get ill, recover, and then inoculated them with the virus again. And those monkeys did not get sick again, but that's the best that I've heard.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a reason to believe that the 18 months or 12 months for a vaccine would get accelerated at all?
I think it's hard to envision vaccine development being any faster than 12 months. It just takes a long time to sort of develop the vaccine itself, test it in people, wait long enough to see the results of that vaccine, and then scale up the production of it at a population level. So I think it's unlikely to be any faster than 12 months.
Are there things they worry about when they're developing a vaccine? Are there side effects to a vaccine that they worry about that they're looking for?
Certainly. I mean, so some vaccines, the second you get it, you get a reaction. You know, it excites your immune system, and people can get little fevers or muscle aches. You know, rarely there are more severe reactions that we certainly want to watch out for. I think the recent example in infectious diseases is the vaccine for dengue, where sometimes when people got that vaccine, the next time that they were exposed to dengue, they actually had a more severe response to the infection because their immune system sort of triggered this very robust response. And so I don't think we have any reason to think that that's what will happen with coronavirus. It's obviously the fear that we would want to know before we recommend it for everybody.
All right, I'm gonna go along kind of a side street here. If we're developing this coronavirus vaccine now, how come we don't do vaccines for just the common cold and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, some of it has to do with the, you know, the common cold. Lots of different viruses cause the common cold, so you would need lots of different vaccines against a bunch of different bugs, and the mortality or the consequences of most common colds are lower, and so we don't really necessarily think that the investment in talking people into all of those vaccines makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I think sometimes it's also been harder to figure out how to develop an effective vaccine. I think it just hasn't been the motivation prior.
So I'm sure a lot of patients are approaching you scared. And same thing is happening up here. A lot of fear, a lot of worry. What are you telling your patients to help them along with these fears? What are you telling people around you to kind of allay the fears a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I try to put things in perspective. It's just, you know, the majority of patients who are infected tend to have a mild illness that doesn't require hospitalization. And then, you know, also provide the perspective that, you know, if you start feeling worse or you start, you know, getting more symptomatic, that's the sign that come in, and just empower people to be really attentive to their symptoms and how they're doing. But I hear the fears. I mean, I think that inevitably a lot of people are going to get sick, and we've already seen, you know, many people pass away.
So I ask a lot of questions of Dr. Google myself and have consulted frequently. I looked about a week ago, and the youngest death I could find was 14 in the entire world. But since then, we had an infant die yesterday, and we had a 5-year-old die fairly recently. Is this a change in the virus, or is it just patients who were in very poor health, do you think? Is there any change that you're seeing the way it's attacking people?
I don't think we've seen a change in the way it's attacking people. My guess is that it's people who otherwise have underlying medical conditions. So, you know, people who have, you know, certain cancers or transplants can die from the common cold if they get it. And so I think some of it may just be that playing out. And then some of it is also that numbers game. So if the likelihood of death from something is very, very low, but enough people are exposed to it, then somebody's going to be that unlucky person who has a severe outcome.
You know, this brings up a question that in pregnant patients, are we seeing any transmission or vertical transmission? What's the data showing?
So there's, as you can imagine, not a lot of data about it, but the data that we've seen has been, I think, pretty reassuring that we think that if transmission happens, it's something that would happen sort of after delivery, and that's why, you know, there's recommendations about if you have the ability to, you know, pump and not directly breastfeed and then have somebody else feed the baby, that would be the greatest way to reduce, you know, post-delivery transmission. But I don't think we've seen much that makes us worried about transmission during pregnancy. Certainly we'll learn more with time, but what we know so far is reassuring.
Has the type of treatment being offered when people come in with advanced symptoms, has it changed over the last 2 weeks?
I haven't seen much of a change over the last 2 weeks. You know, I think the biggest change is I think a lot of institutions, again, are very eager to study medications in a systematic way. And so if more studies are getting approved and on board, that may change things. But in terms of what we're typically recommending right now, it's just standard of care, which would be what we would recommend for anybody for anything. So if you need oxygen, give them oxygen. If you have too much fluid in your body, get rid of some of that fluid. That's still the majority of what's being offered in addition to clinical trials.
I have another listener question, and this is something that's come into my office pretty often. I've had people say, I think this was developed by the Chinese government as a weapon. I've heard people say that the U.S. developed it as a weapon. Today I heard it was caused by 5G telephones. but what kind of research is happening to find the source of the virus?
That's a good question. I think there's almost certainly this is something that happens as a transmission from animals to humans, and it's more likely to happen in areas where there's dense populations of animals intermingling. And, you know, there's a lot of routine surveillance of animals out in the wild and in markets. And I think, I would hope that this experience would ramp up our surveillance mechanisms to better understand what's circulating. But I think mostly just in looking at animals in the communities, I think this probably was initially in bats and, you know, made its way through other hosts to humans.
Going to change gears again for a second. So one thing that's come up a couple times is from your research, is it better to use alcohol on your hands, alcohol sanitizer, or is it better good old soap and water?
I think either is fine. As far as we can tell, whatever is better for you and you're going to be more likely to use that.
So we've avoided that. We haven't talked about ventilators. And the only question I have is if you feel that somebody does need to be placed on the ventilator, do you think that you have time to prepare your staff and make sure they're protected before you put that person on the ventilator? Is it going to, this isn't trauma where somebody needs an intervention like immediately. You know, what's the recommendation on how quick somebody, if they need to be on a ventilator, do we have an hour to do that, or is it 10 minutes, or, you know, what's your thoughts?
That's a good question, and that's the thing that, you know, I think a lot of people have been thinking about. Folks in other cities that have seen more of this have generally been offering the recommendation to, if you see that somebody's need for oxygen is increasing really quickly, to intubate earlier so that it doesn't become an emergent intervention. But you do have time to put on all of your protective gear and reduce the risk of spreading to other people. That's a good question. Obviously, sort of run into the challenge of you don't want to intubate too early and then use up all of your ventilators, so I think it becomes a difficult challenge.
So if a family does get somebody who tests positive, what should we be telling them as a family to be doing? We talked about a little bit, paper plates, trying to keep separate as possible. What other suggestions? Should people be wearing masks in the house at that point? What do you do?
That's a good question. You know, I think some of it probably depends on the health of other people in the family. I think if there's somebody in that household who is an older adult or who, for any other reason, is at higher risk for severe outcomes, I think that you would want to, if you have a mask, put it on the infected family member for sure. And then keep a distance longer than you think you have to. So our current recommendation is that people continue isolation for 1 to 2 weeks from the first day that you feel symptoms until, you know, 2 to 3 days after you feel completely better. So no fever without using Tylenol, your breathing is better. You know, continue keeping a distance for a couple of days even after that.
So we talked briefly about Tylenol. There's some concern about using ibuprofen. What are you telling your patients about using ibuprofen?
We're not really making much of a recommendation one way or another. You know, there was some early concern, mostly theoretical, that ibuprofen would predispose people to more severe outcomes, but I don't think that that's played out yet, and it's something that a lot of people are looking at with a lot of interest. But right now, it's too much for us to weigh in one way or another. I don't know enough.
I've got a question about the aerosol. You mentioned that it's the 6 foot distance is really important because when someone who's infected coughs, it goes into the air. But my question is, how long does it stay in the air? If you go through aisle 6 in the store, you know, are you going through a cloud that was deposited there an hour before?
We don't think so. So there are certain infections that are airborne or that aerosolize. So it's something like tuberculosis, where if somebody with tuberculosis was coughing in aisle 6 an hour ago and you walk through it, certainly you could be exposed. We don't think that coronavirus spreads that way. We think of it as being droplets, the sort of larger particles that when they're expelled into the air, sink to the ground much more quickly.
And so we kind of talk about a viral load usually with how sick a person is. What kind of viral load do you feel like it takes to get infected with this? Does it take a droplet, or will just a few virus infect a person?
That's a good question. I mean, I think certainly the larger amount that you're exposed to, the higher risk you are at getting infected. But I don't know what the strict cutoff is of how much you need to be exposed to get an infection. I don't know that anybody knows that yet.
So another listener question. How would you, going back in history, how would you look at this and compare it to the Spanish flu from 1918? It's a big part of not only Kodiak history, but everyone's history around the world. How do you compare it to that?
So I think there have obviously been a lot of comparisons about that in terms of, you know, how much it's changing everybody's life, in terms of how broadly spread the infection is. You know, I think the thing that is so different now is how quickly science is developing. You know, so in the Spanish flu, they really didn't have much in the way of good treatments and didn't really have the capability to test new treatments quickly, develop new treatments or preventative measures. And I think now the scientific community seems to be really united around sharing information, sharing ideas, kind of helping everybody out. In some ways, very similar, and in some positive ways, very different.
And so I also had some people question me, why is the Spanish flu not a big deal now? Why don't we keep talking about it?
Or maybe more recently in our memory, H1N1, back in 2009, you know, I think it was a new strain of influenza that was, you know, people in the community did not have baseline immunity to, and so people's susceptibility to infection from it was a lot greater. And now that it's, you know, people have seen that virus before, the general herd immunity to it is stronger, and your reaction when you get exposed to it is a lot better because your immune system is able to help you out. The first time you're exposed to a virus is always the worst.
So Spanish flu had a death rate of about 2.5%. I've seen lots of figures. Do you think this is going to end up being better or worse? Where do you think it's going to fall out? It's hard to figure out what we need to divide by because there's so many people who probably got it and already over it. How deadly is this one that we're looking at?
It is hard to know. So, you know, the general estimate is that it may settle out somewhere around 1%, but it's hard to know how to divide by. We don't know who's been exposed and had no symptoms or mild symptoms and never got tested. And it's also hard to know, you know, what the total number of deaths is related to it. So any day that you do a test, you know, the amount of deaths that you see that day reflect people who were tested previously. Like, that death count is always going to lag. And so I think it's just going to be a while until both the numerator and the denominator to calculate the case fatality rate are known.
Unless you have some more questions, I think we're well past time, and we've taken up probably enough of your time that's probably being used for other places. Dr. Laura Platt, thank you very much for helping us understand what's going on there and from giving us your perspective, and best of luck to you and your and what you're dealing with there on the ground in Boston.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks for sharing your experiences up in Kodiak.
And you should come up and visit your brother sometime so you can see it in a better time.
Thank you, Dr. Platt.
Thank you all.